Okay, we're just coming up on 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. As per usual, you will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a question or a comment, and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Welcome again to any new people we have with us tonight, and hope you enjoy our Q&A session and participate. Later on this evening, courtesy of Alan, we will have the contents of the chat window, the audio track, and the PDF of the slides will go up on our website, so you can review all that material. And I think with that, I will kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. And we'll get right into it because we've got quite a number of different things to talk about tonight. First up, we have an item about failing SSDs. This was actually on the user forum. There was quite a bit of chat about this. Normand had a problem where his system basically just lost both his Windows C drive and a Windows D drive. But yeah, and he was left with his Linux system, which was running on a second hard drive. And it turned out it was a hard drive failure after quite a bit of discussion. So he found out that he actually had a 5-year warranty on this solid state drive. So he got the number to send it back, and he says he was glad to keep the bill of sale. So Bob Harris followed up and congratulated him for doing that, but made a really good point. He says, "I'm sure everyone is now scrambling to set up a receipt filing system." So, in other words, you really need to, and the chat just ahead of this meeting was all about different versions of Office and whether you'd bought them, whether you had the key for it. The moral of the story is when you buy equipment, write stuff down and keep things orderly. And especially receipts if you need to send things back. But things like authorization keys and the actual numeric or the alphanumeric string that you need to enter to make the thing work, keep that because you never know that one of these days you might have to reactivate something. So personally, I have a maintenance log file for my computer, and all of those kind of numbers are right at the front of the file, so I know where they are. And my file is backed up onto my USB drive every time I use a computer. So I'm pretty sure I've got a good working copy of it.
Tom made a suggestion in the chat that take a picture of receipts, serial numbers on machines and save to a folder with a descriptive name. I do a similar sort of thing where, especially when stores or shipments will come with an electronic version of the receipts and all of the particulars, and I have a folder by vendor. And I just save all of those things into there and keep them until I get rid of it.
Yep, good idea. Thanks for that, Tom. Okay, so next up we were talking, Jocelyn had a question at last week's Q&A, whether you need a cache partition, a swap area, or a Linux installation. And we were talking about dual boot systems, so you do need two partitions, one for Windows and one for Linux. But Justin's real question was, you have to have one for the Linux operating system and a separate partition for the swap area or the file cache, or as Windows calls it, the paging file. So you can have a swap area in Linux, but I kind of said that when I did the installation of the dual boot system, because I was doing it alongside Windows, it didn't ask me, other than how big do I want the Linux partition, it didn't ask me whether I wanted a swap partition, and I didn't think I got one. And in fact, I didn't because I checked again. So here's a GNOME parted view of my hard drive before installing Linux. So you can see that at the bottom there, there's a 230 gigabyte partition, which is set up as NTFS, and that is my Windows 10 partition. And then when I do the dual boot, that partition gets shrunk to 195 gigabytes, and the Linux partition is set to be 35 gigabytes. So that's an ext4 partition, which is the Linux native file system. But you notice that there's no swap area designated, so you don't actually need a swap area in Linux. Okay, next up, Chris, maybe you'd like to remind everybody about our one-on-one assistance program.
Yeah, sure. Let me just paste this in. We talked about this a number of times. There's been articles in the newsletter about it as well. We're ready to go with it. We've yet to receive any requests through this. The whole idea behind the one-on-one remote assistance program is that if you have something that cannot be easily solved through a venue such as Q&A, where you really go, well, gee, if somebody could actually see my screen, or they see this error message, or I don't know how to edit the registry, and I'm really nervous to do it myself because I know it can make my computer unbeautiful if I do wrong things. Could somebody do it for me? Well, we can actually do that remotely. And so a broad overview of the program, you would send in your request for assistance to one-on-one request at opcug.ca. And then your request will get forwarded to a group of volunteers. We have 10 people who have said that they may be able to help out. And if we go out to that group, if somebody on that group looks at your particular problem and says, yeah, I can help with that, then they will actually communicate directly with you and set up a time that they can communicate or connect remotely to your computer. They'll be able to see what's on your screen, and under normal circumstances, I would suggest that you give them the ability, you have to give them that ability to operate your mouse and keyboard so they can actually act as if they're sitting in front of your keyboard, in front of your computer. And then if the problem presumably gets resolved and you're asked to provide feedback on the process. So the doors are open. If anybody has a need for that, by all means, send in that request to that email address and we can get things rolling.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And if anybody wants to volunteer to join that group of volunteers, we're open to that too. Okay, Chris, your next item is a share about tracking systems.
Yeah, I get an email weekly, I guess, or this couple of weeks that come out from the intelligence, and this was in their Cool Tools email. And I actually do recommend that people sign up for this newsletter. It has very interesting information that comes out. But at any rate, the intelligence.com is where you can actually go to sign up for it. And this one was a particular item where it was called Blacklight. And it's a real-time privacy inspector for websites. So you can tell, you know, if somebody is actually trying to track you on the internet, Blacklight will scan any web page you feed it, and it will reveal any user tracking technologies that are on that site, and they will try to identify who is actually getting that data. You might be surprised at what you learn. I certainly was a little bit surprised at the magnitude of tracking that is going on some sites. So as an example, my favorite photo editor is On One Photo Raw. And so I go to the website for Blacklight, and I plug in their website. So www.on1.com. And it came back and it said that there were 8 ad trackers found on the site. There were 9 third-party cookies found. And when I go and visit that site, it tells Facebook the fact that I actually went to that site. So it was above average number of ad trackers. It was triple the average for third-party cookies. And then, again, it finked on me to Facebook anytime I visited that page. And interestingly, some of the ad tech companies this website interacted with, Adobe. Well, Adobe makes Photoshop and Lightroom and other things like that. So why would On One want to tell Adobe that I was on their site, which is strictly photo editing software? Kind of bizarre. If you want a little bit more explanation, you can click on the upside down chevron on any of them. And in this case here, I just clicked on the one beside the third-party cookies found, and it tells you a little bit about what those third-party cookies actually do and so forth. So should you be concerned? Well, you know, I look at the description for ad trackers, and it says what it can be done is build an advertising profile, identify you for ad targeting, and it can profile you. Now, is that a concern? Only you can answer that question, I guess. The one about thinking on you to Facebook, they've talked to Facebook, and they say a Facebook spokesperson said it was set up the system so that a user doesn't have to be simultaneously logged into Facebook and viewing a third-party website for our business tools to function, whatever the heck that is. I'm not all that enamored with the idea that they have business tools looking at my usage on the web, but it's happening. And it can include the common actions that can be tracked are viewing a web page or adding payment information or making a purchase. So when websites are thinking on you to Facebook, it can be a matter of telling Facebook that you're on a particular website making a purchase. I don't know if that's a really good thing. And then capturing keystrokes. This is really interesting. One of the categories on there is if they find that a website is capturing user keystrokes before you hit a submit button. Now, there is one circumstance in there that it actually sort of makes sense, is that one reason for doing key logging is for providing autocomplete functionality. So that's, you see that when you're searching at Google or something, and you start typing in something, and it comes up with some suggestions of what you might want to search on. Well, the way they're doing that is they're actually capturing your keystrokes in real time rather than waiting until you click on, okay, I want to search on the following. So maybe it's not as nefarious as it first appears to be. Some of the other sites that I came across, which sort of eye-watering in their amount of tracking and so forth, PC Magazine, 65 ad trackers found on the site, 104 third-party cookies, and they think to Facebook as well. Another one, The Verge, which is a tech news site, 82 ad trackers, 190 third-party cookies. And Fox News, 74 ad trackers, 76 third-party cookies, and this website loads trackers on your computer that are designed to evade third-party cookie blockers. I think that is nefarious almost by definition, that if they are trying to evade when you have a third-party cookie blocker and they're trying to get around that, that is really not good, I think. So what about the Ottawa PC User Group? Well, I went to there, and phew, we have zero ad trackers, zero third-party cookies. We don't evade cookie blockers. We don't do session recording services. We don't capture keystrokes. We don't think to Facebook, and Google Analytics is not invoked. So you can rest assured that if you come to our website, we're doing nothing to track you. So can you actually do anything about this? And at the Q&A in 2014, we've talked about trackers and that a number of times, and I put the links to each of the ones that I found in the archive where we actually did talk about it. So if you are interested in trying to get around this tracking and so forth, there are some things you can do. It looks like not all things are going to work all of the time, but even if they work only part of the time, then maybe it's not a bad thing if you're concerned about tracking. And that's all I have on that one.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. Tom had put a bunch of suggestions in the chat on other pieces of software that will look at cookies and tracking software and so on and so forth. Okay, next up, I extended security updates for Windows 10, and I actually put this in the user forum when it first came out, but if you didn't see it there, this is just a reminder that Windows 10 reaches end of life in just under a year now, October the 14th, 2025, However, Microsoft has indicated that it will offer extended security updates, and these will be critical and security updates, but you will not get any new features, there'll be no bug fixes, and there will be no technical support anymore for Windows 10. If you decide to take advantage of this service, this program, the cost is going to be $30 for one computer. However, the update program only runs for 1 year. So you're paying $30, but all you're really doing is buying 12 months worth of time. So if you do buy the update program, then in October 2026, you're back to square one in terms of scratching your head and wondering what to do about Windows 10. But at least the $30 buys you an extra year if that's of use to you, I guess.
I think that this is actually bad. Just before we move on, I think that's actually bad news because I really thought that there was no way that they could go and tell the, you know, billion-plus computers out there that are running Windows 10, we're not going to provide security updates anymore. And so I thought they were going to extend the end of life for Windows 10. But if they have this program in place, they probably aren't going to extend the end of life for Windows 10, and because they'll just say, well, if you want updates, yeah, it just costs you $30 a computer. So I suspect that the end of life is going to be stuck at October 14th, 2025. So if you're on it, might be a good idea to start planning ahead for what you're going to do at that point, whether you spend $30 or look for a new computer or move to Linux or whatever.
Or spend $30 and spend 2 years thinking about moving to a new computer.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so everybody knows, I think, my plan is to trade up to Linux, probably completely, almost completely anyway.
One other alternative is to use ZeroPatch. ZeroPatch will give you all the security updates for an unlimited period of time until they don't have any more customers for if you want to stay with Windows 10.
It will give you the security patches that ZeroPatch can provide.
Yeah.
But that will be all of them. Because
they're not Microsoft. That's the only issue I have with that.
I know, but what they do is they go into the patches that Microsoft makes to all their Windows, and they see if it affects a previous version, and then they update it in that version. It does cost money, but it's less than the $30 a year.
Okay. All right, so I said that my plan is to move up to Linux, and this is part five. We've looked at creating a live USB, testing the system with it. We've looked at installing it as a dual boot system. So now we're in the situation where we have an actual version of Linux installed on our computer that we can actually use. But first of all, we have to do a bit of configuration, and tonight I'm just going to focus on two things. Activating a firewall, or the firewall that's built into Linux, and the update system, because that's really important, and it's quite different, the Windows update system. So, interesting enough, Linux does have a built-in firewall. It's called the Uncomplicated Firewall, UFW. But for some strange reason, and when you install Linux, the firewall is not activated. So you have to activate it manually, as it were. Now, it's not terribly difficult. If you navigate in the menu to preference, when you click on firewall configuration, it loads this window that we see right here, and you can see that there's a toggle switch right here for status, and that is disabled. Clearly, if you move that to the right or just click on that, then the status becomes active, and the shield just changed to a beautiful gated firewall. And the basic rules are any incoming traffic is going to be denied, and any outgoing traffic is going to be allowed. Now, if you want to do something much more complicated than that, then you have this rules tab, and you can set up all kinds of different rules, whatever you want to do. But for most of humanity, probably having this firewall activated and just the baseline rules of deny incoming and accept outgoing is probably good enough. okay, the update manager. The panel in Linux is along the bottom of the screen, and in Windows you would call that a taskbar. And on the right-hand end of this panel, there's a bunch of icons, system icons. It's like a system tray. And one of them is this shield icon. And when there's an orange dot or a yellow dot, whatever you want to call it, that indicates that updates are available. The good news about the update manager in Linux is that it's completely under the user's control. It tells you that updates are available, but it's up to you to decide, yes, I would like to install those updates now. And when you do that, you also get the opportunity to say, I want them all, or I only want that one, or I want six of them. It's completely under the user's control how the update program operates. There are three categories of updates. There are security updates, kernel updates, and software updates, because when you install Linux, not only do you get the operating system and the relative drivers, we also get bundled applications. So the update process takes care of updating the applications that you have installed, as well as your operating system. So that's another difference between Linux and Windows. As we'll find, the recommendation is to apply all of the available updates, and I would certainly recommend that you follow that advice. So when you first launch Update Manager, you end up with this kind of splash screen, which tells you a bit about the thing, that the different kind of updates, and also this business of system snapshots, which we'll come back to later on. And then when you go by that screen, then the next thing it asks you is whether you want to install or whether you want to switch to a local mirror. Now, if you remember when we downloaded the Linux ISO file, we could have downloaded it from the Linux Mint website itself, but we were also given the opportunity to select from mirror sites all over the world, and a couple of sites were in Canada. And I use the one at the Manitoba Unix user group. So I could set the updates to run off a Canadian mirror too. But in fact, my experience is that just leaving it as linuxmint.com, the default, it works just fine. So personally, I just press no and leave the mirror as the Linux Mint mirror, the Linux Mint website itself, repository itself. All right, so there are, as I said, there are these three types of updates. So you have the security ones, which are critical, you know, like install right now, vulnerabilities and security flaws in either the operating system or any of the installed software. And you'll also get kernel updates every now and again. The Linux kernel is ever evolving, and occasionally the Linux team will decide that they're going to update to a new version of the kernel. And then because we've got that bundle software, we can also have software updates, and they're designated by an arrow. And so that gives, when you first install Linux, and it's probable that that ISO has been around on the website for quite a few weeks. And it's quite likely that the update system has produced a lot of different updates. And so this is the first time running Windows update, Linux update after installing Linux. And you notice that at the time downloads. Now that's really unusual. You never usually get anything like that. So this is really just a post-installation one-time operation. But the good news is it tells us that it shows us that we've got these three different kind of updates. We've got the security updates up top here with the shields. There is a kernel update available. We're going to kernel 6.8 and change up arrow here. And because we've got a kernel update, when we say install the updates right here, then it triggers some dependencies. So in addition to the various software that we were shown earlier, we need all these other packages as kind of additional software packages that are part of the kernel upgrade in this case. And again, I don't pick and choose, just say okay and install everything that they suggest. Once you decide that, once you tell it to go ahead and install, then it starts giving you these progress dialog boxes. So here you can see that it's downloading, it's doing that, and how long, it's got 2.5 minutes basically to go, and the progress bar will chug along across here, so you can see how things are progressing. If you want to, you can click on this link right here to show individual files, and this dialog box will open up, and you will see a whole bunch of lines of text as individual files are being processed and completed. And then once it's downloaded everything, then there's a second similar dialog box which tells you how the installation of these packages is going. And again, you can get the time needed to do the installation, and you can look at the individual files that are being installed, should you so wish. And when you've got a gigabyte of files to download, it's going to take a few minutes. So personally, I just let the thing run and go make myself a cup of coffee probably. And when I come back, it will say your system is all everything that was available. Tom's asking if there's a way to display the current besides the new. If you go into the updates, and it will tell you which version you have in there. So some of that information at least is available. Okay, this top dialog box here is the recommendation. It recommends to set up automated system snapshots and to apply all available updates. Now, system snapshots is a program called TimeShift. And what it does is it takes historical snapshots of the system files, so the operating system, but not your personal data files. So system snapshots are not an alternative to making backups. So personally, I don't use system snapshots. I make regular full disk images of my entire hard drive. And I typically do that once a month to align with Patch Tuesday for Windows. And basically, if I have to restore a disk image, I'm usually a few weeks behind in updates, but all I have to do is run the update program and everything will get brought up to date. So it's not a huge issue. And as I indicated earlier, I also use Free File Sync to synchronize my data files on my dedicated data drive to an external USB flash drive. And I do that every time I use a computer, every session. So I always have a current snapshot of my data files. So personally, I don't use system snapshots. I use the imaging and the synchronization apps to make sure I can restore things. However, when it comes to software updates, I do follow the recommendation. I always apply all the available updates. And I could pick and choose. As you saw, there were check marks where you can check a box or uncheck a box to have a particular update installed or not. But personally, I figure that the Linux team, the Mint team, they know better than I do what kind of files, what kind of updates should be applied to my system. So I basically apply all the available updates. The thing about updates is that you get them quite frequently. Every few days at least, and sometimes every day, there might be one or three or more updates. The thing is, they're available very frequently, but usually there's not very many of them, and they're also not very big. So when you see what they are, you hit install updates, it takes, you know, seconds usually to do the update process, and you don't have to worry about it. But the really good thing about this Linux system, as far as I'm concerned, is this bottom bullet here. I'm in charge of when the updates happen. I don't have this business of Windows Update suddenly kicking in, and I'm locked out of my machine until the update process finishes sometimes, which I find really annoying. And in fact, what I do is I tell Windows that I'm on a metered connection, even though I'm not. And so typically it won't do updates because it thinks I'm having to pay for them, and I'm going to authorize it when it needs to do it. So most of the time I am in control of the Windows update process. But again, I can't pick and choose which updates I want typically. Here, everything's in my control, and especially I decide when these updates happen. For me, that's really important. Okay, that's all I have on moving to Linux for now.
We had a couple of questions. There is Thomas, what file system do you like in Linux?
I typically use the default, which is ext4. It's a journaling file system like NTFS, but it is Linux specific. And one of the issues is that Windows pretends it doesn't know about ext4, whereas Linux is quite happy to read FAT32 and NTFS and almost anything else you throw at it. So my Linux system is ext4.
And Joss asks, what imaging program?
My dedicated data drive is NTFS, because then I can use the same data files on both Windows, which understands NTFS, and Linux, which is happy to use NTFS. Imaging program. These days, I've moved to Foxclone. Foxclone is a program that you install on a live USB. So it's like having a rescue disk, except it's not just to recover. You actually use the live USB to image the disk in the first place. So I basically plug in my USB, run Foxclone, save the images to an external USB drive, which is normally not plugged in. And then if I need to restore something, then I can plug in Foxclone, plug in my external USB, and do a restore. And Foxclone gives me the option of restoring the whole image, i.e. the whole hard drive, Windows and Linux and my dedicated drive. Or I can say just restore the Linux partition and leave the Windows and the data drive as they were. So it's fairly convenient, and it's very flexible, and it works exceedingly well. Okay, I think that's it for questions on Linux then. So let's move on to a website or a YouTube channel that I found recently. This is actually a YouTube video. 10 pieces of software that are better than Windows. And it has things in there like VLC. I can't remember what all the others are right now. But some of the software products that are in there are programs that I use regularly. So if you're interested in free software that may be better than things, this video. Fairly short and, 8 minutes it says. Fairly short and concise, but lots of good programs in there for your consideration. Okay, next up we have a question came in from Elizabeth, and she'd been receiving these messages saying that she needed to plug her laptop in because the battery was low. However, kind of odd because the laptop was plugged in, because it's always plugged in, and she leaves it plugged in, and so it's not a question of the battery being low because it's always being charged. So she checked the power cord. It was, the connection was firm. The AC adapter was warm when it's working, so that's good. But she says, normally, ideally, what she'd like is to have an icon on the taskbar that shows, yes, the battery is being used, or alternatively, the computer's plugged in, or both. And so she Googled that, but couldn't find it. So I knew this thing, it was out there somewhere. I'd seen it on my laptop at some time or other, but again, it wasn't on mine either. So I went to Perplexity, and I gave Perplexity Elizabeth's original question. How do I know if my Windows laptop is running on the battery or if it's plugged in? And it basically says, check the battery icon. Now, the problem is we don't know where the battery icon is because it's not on the taskbar. So I asked the nice thing about Perplexity is you can ask follow-up questions. So I asked the follow-up question, what displays the battery icon? Like, where does this battery icon come from? And if you read the stuff here, it says enable the power icon. So it's the problem Elizabeth was having probably was looking for battery icon when Windows calls it a power icon. And sure enough, you can select taskbar settings and then go to the notification and enable the power icon, and then you will see the power icon on the taskbar. So sometimes Googling is a bit fraught trying to find the right terminology. I find Perplexity and these chatbots are a bit more forthcoming with their answers and with their ability to pose more questions, which are related to the question that you asked earlier. So you can have like a thread of questioning going through the system and hopefully eventually drill down to the item that you really need. Okay, another question that came in is Chris is going to talk about.
Yes, this came in from B, and she had a pop-up on her desktop, came in saying PC App Store, and had a whole bunch of settings on it. She didn't recognize it, didn't know what had caused it to come onto her computer, and was asking if that is actually a problem or not. And so this turned out to be a little bit more of a rabbit hole than I originally envisioned, but going along with as Alan was doing things, I decided, well, why not ask Perplexity AI? One of the things I like about Perplexity AI is that it does give you the references of where it found the answer. So it comes up with a very nice comprehensive way of presenting the answer and then tells you where it got the various components within that answer so that you can validate them and see if they make sense to you as well. So I said, what is PC App Store? Is it malicious? And so Perplexity answered on it, said that it's a legitimate software distribution platform and owned by a UK-based company. But they said that it's frequently exploited by cyber criminals to distribute malware. So I guess the way that it's structured, people can pick up that piece of software and actually use it to distribute malware. Not so good. And it likely is bundled with other software, or it comes with when you install something else. It could be installing this as part of some other program you install. And they said potentially including malicious programs, also not good. And then they had associated risks that were involved with that. So it could display unwanted advertisements, gather your personal data, and install other unwanted applications. All of those are probably things that you don't necessarily want on your computer, especially the last two. So they said the solution is to get rid of it, and you could do it either through a manually remove or use a reputable antivirus program. So that was kind of interesting that they had two options for how you get rid of it. And the main one was just going and uninstalling it as a normal Windows application. So they're claiming that if you go to Settings, Apps, Install Apps, or in Windows 10, Settings, Apps, Apps and Features, it should be listed in there. So you just find it, PC App Store. And this is kind of what you would expect, considering that it's supposed to be a legitimate Windows application. So you can go ahead and right-click on it and choose Uninstall. So that's one way of doing it. But they went on to saying there are maybe some other things that you want to do as well. And my advance is not happening. Alan, can you advance us? Oh, I think our problem is that Alan's connection is frozen. So let's see if we can get this. We're jumping ahead, all kinds of things. Okay, hang on. I'm going to back up a little bit. If I can back up. Okay, let's try again. I'm getting a lot of lag here. Just a second. Okay, so one more. There we go. So they went on and they said there's some additional things that you should actually do. And I think these may be required and maybe not. But they recommend it be done, so it's probably not a bad idea to check it. It gets a little bit more involved to do these things. So they said delete remaining files. So they search for PC App Store, as all one word with no spaces, as well as FA_RSS in any file names or folders, and delete them. Now, they said that you might actually have to take ownership of the files, they say if needed. I don't know if this is a common problem or not, but basically they give you the instructions on how to do that as well. So you can right-click on a file or folder, and go to Properties, Security tab in Advanced, click the Change next to the Owner field, go to Advanced, Find Now, and then select your username from the list so that you can add yourself as the owner of the particular files. And that would go through that. And then they said, if that doesn't work, If it doesn't work, you can actually do it from the command prompt, and there's two commands that you have to do. The first is take own, which, we've got all kinds of lags here. There we go. Okay. So take own, it takes ownership of it, of a particular file. If some system or something else has got ownership of it and is not letting you delete the files, so they give you the command line to do that. And then you use iCackles, which is setting the permissions on the files to give all administrators full access to it. And then you should be able to actually go ahead and delete the files that are in question. Now, that gets a little bit involved if you have to go down that far to do it. But it is kind of nice that they do give you those extra instructions that can get you out of a hole. Then they say you should scan with antivirus software. Not a bad thing if you think that there's anything malicious that's on your computer, for sure. And then reset the browser settings. So they're thinking that maybe in all of this that the malicious software has done some things to your browser settings. So in Chrome, you can go to Settings, just put in the search box for Reset Settings, and note that it'll disable extensions and it deletes cookies and other temporary site data. So if you don't want cookies deleted for whatever reason, you may not want to do this reset. They say that bookmarks, history, and saved passwords should not be affected by doing that. In Firefox, you go to Help, and then More Troubleshooting Information, refresh Firefox, and it will actually remove the extensions and customizations, and bookmarks and passwords should not be affected. So you can do that. And then they suggest that you also clear your browser data and cache, which, again, if you think there's something malicious going on, is probably not a bad idea. They also suggest that you should empty your recycle bin and restart your computer. So a whole bunch of steps that they suggest you should actually do in order to make sure you get rid of everything to do with this particular piece of software that's a problem. So if this is not for the faint of heart, so there are some things you're doing at the command line, and you're digging down into permissions on files, and you're setting ownership on files. And if you don't feel comfortable following all those steps, you know, maybe that would be a good candidate for using the one-on-one remote assistance. We have our 10 volunteers that at least a few of them are very comfortable at using these sort of tools. And so it would be a pretty rapid call to actually be able to connect to your computer, run those on your behalf, and make sure that they complete successfully. And so if you are interested in that, be sure to reference this Q&A session so that any volunteer can go through and they can get all of the step-by-step instructions that they would have to go through. So do whatever you can whenever you initiate a one-on-one remote assistance request to make sure that you give as much information as possible to the people who are willing to help so that they can successfully solve your problem. And then I have one more slide on this one. So it went on at Perplexity as well. It had a bit for preventing future infections. So they urge caution when downloading free software, and adware is often bundled with it. Only download software from official sources. Sometimes that can be a little bit hard to determine what is an official source, but to the extent that you can, it's not a bad idea. Keep your operating system and software up to date so that you prevent compromise on known vulnerabilities that have been fixed, and you can get those patches and so forth so that you don't get compromised. And as always, use reliable antivirus program with real-time protection. And lastly, you might want to attend Protecting Your PC at the Ottawa Public Library. I have given that session 98 times so far at various branches of the Ottawa Public Library over the 16 years or so we've been giving presentations there. And so if you go to that link, and I'll paste that into the chat, you'll see if we have any upcoming ones. We have a new round for January through March, which will be coming out probably within the next month or so. We'll be getting those out there. So there may be additional ones on protecting your PC. And that's all I have on that.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Chris. Okay, next item in the user forum this evening, a message popped up basically saying from Micheline Johnson that today she is 90 years old. So I don't think Micheline's on the call right now. Maybe she's having a birthday party. But if you want to wish her happy birthday, then she's very active on the user forum. So send your congratulations to her. And just about at the last 10. So if anybody has any other questions or wants to chat about things that we've already talked about, now's the time. Put something in the chat window, open your microphone, wave your hand, send Chris a beer by FedExpress. I don't know. Well, while everybody's thinking about it, let me do the. Let me talk about some other things, the wrap up stuff. Coming up at the Ottawa Public Library sessions, Chris has already mentioned one or two of them. Linda and Chris have got a whole raft of sessions coming up in November, and this is just a selected few. So tomorrow, Linda's doing restoring old photographs. So if you want to get rid of those cracks and bubbles in old prints, create digital copies and basic photo editing, and Linda's got a session at Rockcliffe Park on the 14th. And the other thing we've got is in collaboration with NCF, the Freenet, Chris is doing a session on password managers on the 13th in the afternoon at 2 o'clock, and you have to register with NCF to attend that. So Chris is going to be busy on the 13th because he's got this session on the at 2 o'clock, and then he'll be hosting our monthly meeting at 7 o'clock in the evening that day. And we have a guest speaker, Brett Martinson, who is going to talk to us about various aspects of artificial intelligence. And Chris has seen the deck, and he says it's really interesting. And so that should be a good session to attend. I don't see any questions yet, so I'll carry on and say we have speakers booked now through January of next year, so January 2025. But right now we have nothing booked after that. So what do you need to know about computing systems, any aspect of computers that we could provide a presentation on? And in particular, do you know any speakers who can make presentations on these kind of topics? If you do, then please let us know at our suggestion box email address. And we'll take all of your suggestions into consideration. And then finally, for the wrap monthly meeting next week on the 13th, we don't have Q&A at the end of monthly meetings, so our next Q&A will actually be in 2 weeks on November the 20th. And right now we have pretty much a free slate for that. So if you have specific questions that you'd like answered, or if you have topics that you'd like to share with your fellow computer users, then again, just let us know some details so we can put you on the agenda. Okay, so I think I can go back to slide 42. Yes. Any other questions?
I see nothing in the chat yet.
Can we go
if home? We missed anything before, by all means, shout out that we missed your question or comment or something like that that needs to be brought forward.
A question. Has anybody used a PS Sense or OPN Sense?
That would require I know what you're talking about. I haven't.
OPN Sense and PS Sense are different, but related firewalls that run on a separate device that can do a variety of filtering things before stuff gets to you or your devices. Well, I guess I'll have to explore and make a presentation on it.
There you go.
Well, there's lots of things that get to us, so I'm sure Carol and I could come up with something.
for sure. Oh, I have heard that, like, when because Alan's computer cuts out, that if we all stop our videos, that it decreases and allows more bandwidth in or something. Is that true or not?
I don't think it's going to affect it. I think it's Alan's internet connection that is affected, or his Wi-Fi that is causing that dropout. I don't think anybody else's use of use or not of video is going to affect it.
I think you should put a 1-1 assistance request in.
I have a 1-1 assistance request to put in.
Oh, good. I think Al needs to put one in.
Oh, yeah. Put into Bell is what I need to do.
You need to get better service.
I think your internet connection, the Ethernet connection, is duplex. So it shouldn't matter how much stuff Alan is downloading. What matters is how it can leave his computer. Maybe you should get a Windows 11 compatible computer, Alan. like a Ryzen 9 or a 20th generation Intel.
Threadripper.
Before we all leave, one of the things I'll point out, Linda's presentation tomorrow night on a restoring old photos at Alta Vista currently has 27 people registered for it. Wow. If you want to attend and you go to register and you're told that there's a wait list, just show up anyways because there's always no shows and the room is actually fairly large. So I wouldn't even worry about registering at all. If you want to come, just come out to the presentation.
For sure there's going to be enough that I will be presenting, but if the room is full, if it happens everybody shows up, that room could easily hold 30 people, but people who have registered, the librarian would give them priority if they knew, but we won't tell anyone.
Yeah, and we always have some no-shows, so I'm sure that anybody who wants to attend tomorrow night, there will be no problem.
Okay, and I'm doing that photo restore again in
a number of times
back in Rockcliffe, I think I'm giving it, and so if it's not feasible, I have other times I'm giving it before the end of December.
Yeah, it seems to be a really popular one for sure. It's been picked up by quite a few branches, and so far has had good registration numbers for it. So and kudos to Linda.
Yeah, and I'm doing it in the West End on the 18th of November at Carlingwood. That's a Monday night, so if you're West End, that one. And I'm giving it Ruthie Dickinson the next day, which is Barhaven. So, yeah, I'm giving that one a lot.
You should put a copy of your presentation up on YouTube.
Well, it's a demo, Tom, so it's the presentation itself is not that long. It's mostly the demo.
Oh, yeah, exactly, but on YouTube, it's live. Mm-hmm. Also, does OPC-UG have a YouTube channel?
No.
I have a YouTube channel, and I've got a few photographic ones, but I haven't taped one for that specific. Yeah, it's not a bad idea. I could do one.
But, yeah, or get someone to video you while you're doing things.
Well, I can just do it through PowerPoint and have it tape the demo and the slides.
It's always good to have like cutouts back and forth. You should ask Bob to get his drone in, and you need a cameraman then.
Yeah, I got 360 going here. Can you make me look tall? That's all I want to know.
Why don't you have one of those steno chairs?
Okay.
Okay, folks. Well, thanks very much for showing up, and we'll see you next week at the regular monthly meeting. And as Alan mentioned, I have seen a previous version, I think, at this point of the deck that is going to be presented, and some really, really good information in there. And so anybody who's interested in any aspect of AI, by all means, come on out and invite your friends.